Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Thursday, December 22, 2016. Beginning with international news, a vote by the UN Security Council on a resolution demanding a halt to Israeli settlement activities on the West Bank and East Jerusalem has been postponed. President-elect Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu urged the Obama administration to veto the UN resolution. In a statement today, Trump says the measure puts Israel in a very poor negotiating position and is extremely unfair to all Israelis. Nothing about fairness to the Palestinians. The draft resolution circulated by Egypt declared that all existing settlements have no legal validity and are a flagrant violation of international law. But Egypt has now bowed to pressure, and Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi told Egypt's UN mission to postpone the vote. In the DRC, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, a crisis. President Joseph Kabila's second term expired on Monday, but he is refusing to leave office. Human Rights Watch says government authorities have sought to silence dissent with threats, violence, and arbitrary arrests. Ida Sawyer is Central Africa Director of Human Rights Watch.
Deliberate strategy by the government, by the security forces, to try to suppress the demonstrations. They're arresting the people who are organizing the demonstration. We've been documenting these kinds of arrests for months now, but it has really picked up in the past week. And in many cases, they're deliberately targeting people who are the key mobilizers, so leaders of youth movements and leaders of the youth wings of opposition political parties who are planning to mobilize, but they get arrested in advance of the demonstrations. So it seems that they're trying to arrest them to stop the demonstrations from going forward and also as an intimidation tactic.
HRW says in eastern Congo, dozens of armed groups remain active. Many of their commanders lead forces that have been responsible for numerous war crimes for which few have been held accountable. Congolese army soldiers have also been responsible for abuses against the civilian population they are meant to protect. In other international news, Syrian state-owned media is reporting that the last remaining rebels are leaving eastern Aleppo with their families. Daniel Johnson reports.
An estimated 35,000 people were reportedly leaving the last opposition-held enclaves east of Aleppo City on Thursday. UN Special Advisor Jan Egeland said that Thursday's internationally monitored evacuation was the largest he'd known and that it had saved a lot of lives. He described how people had left Aleppo in a 1,000-strong dilapidated convoy of buses, cars and trucks. It had been far from easy. Many vehicles had flat tyres, no fuel and were packed full of people. Their problems are not over, he continued.
Tens of thousands of people now from East Aleppo join hundreds and hundreds of thousands internally displaced already. It's a race against the clock and against the winter to provide shelter, warmth and relief to people who are sick, exhausted, malnourished from 5 years of war.
UN-led talks between Syria's warring parties are slated to begin on the 8th of February in Geneva. While insisting that the immediate priority was a cessation of hostilities, Special Envoy Staffan de Mistura noted that snow was falling in Aleppo, increasing humanitarian needs. In addition to this week's unanimous UN Security Council vote on Syria, the UN Special Envoy also noted that several other diplomatic developments may also have an influence on the upcoming talks in the Swiss city. These include the arrival in January of new UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres, who may be able to launch his own initiatives, de Mistura said, as well as the proposed Astana meeting in Kazakhstan between warring parties in the new year. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
The evacuations were set in motion last week after Syria's opposition agreed to surrender its last footholds in eastern Aleppo. Meanwhile, Donald Trump has called for the expansion of the United States' nuclear capabilities until the world comes to its senses regarding nukes. He's using his preferred method of discourse for this stance, Twitter. The tweet comes after Trump met with several military procurement officers to discuss defense budgets. During the campaign, Trump had urged an expanded U.S. arsenal, and he suggested that the world would be better off if other countries, including Japan and South Korea, had nuclear capabilities. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. This week, activists and concerned New Yorkers met at Cooper Union's Great Hall to listen to prominent activists and journalists, professors and faith leaders speak on how to best move forward in the next 4 years. Over 200,000 people tuned into the event on live stream and social media. WBAI's Zach Murphy tells us the event was organized by RefuseFascism.org, and it was just as much a discussion on how to organize against the impending Trump-Pence administration's policy stances as it was a call to mobilize new activists to come together and tackle issues they care deeply about.
Many on the left say that a complacency and deference to the Democratic Party over the last 8 years contributed to a Trump victory. And there is a concern that safeguards put into place in the areas of women's rights, environmental protection laws, voting rights, immigration, and educational funding could be taken away. The worry is that these gains could be crippled by a Trump-Pence administration. Carl Dix, a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and a member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, says that a mass mobilization of citizens can delegitimize the Trump-Pence administration.
Imagine if people in the tens of millions filled the streets, powerfully declaring that this regime is illegitimate and demanding that it not be allowed to rule. The whole political landscape would be dramatically transformed. Every faction within the established power structure would be forced to respond. And all this could well lead to a situation in which this fascist regime is actually prevented from ruling. This is not some idle dream, but something which could be made a reality if all those who hate what is represented by this regime translate their outrage into firm determination and massive mobilization to create the conditions which make this possible. Imagine if people in the tens of millions filled the streets, powerfully declaring that this regime is illegitimate and demanding that it not be allowed to rule. The whole political landscape would be dramatically transformed. Every faction within the established power structure would be forced to respond. And all this could well lead to a situation in which this fascist regime is actually prevented from ruling. This is not some idle dream, but something which could be made a reality if all those who hate what is represented by this regime translate their outrage into firm determination and massive mobilization to create the conditions which make this possible.
Dick says that discussions in academia that include classroom dialogue and campus outreach are vital to achieving a national discourse. Discussions in places of worship, local community gatherings, family gatherings, and social media are the seeds that can give rise to our own Tahrir Square.
Religious gatherings that take place during the holiday season need to be places where people hear about the need to act to stop this fascist regime and get organized into it. You're having family gatherings during the holiday? Well, a topic of discussion has to be the need to stop this Trump-Pence regime and how to do it and getting people organized into it. And then afterward, we got to come back together and take this no, which is the symbol of this effort and the call for this effort to resist, to another level, getting it out everywhere and raising the money needed to make this happen. All this could well lead to a situation in which this fascist regime is actually prevented from ruling. This is not some idle dream, but something which could be made a reality if all those who hate what is represented by this fascist regime translate their outrage into firm determination and massive mobilization to create the conditions which make this possible. For this to happen, we all need to organize on another level. We need to become the organizers of organizers of organizers. We need to throw our all in on this for the next month and more. Because just think what it would have meant if people had been able to join together to stop Hitler before his regime got started. Think of the difference it would have made for humanity. Well, I'm not trying to minimize what Hitler did, But today we're facing a fascist regime that's determined to institute a fascist rule with a finger on the nuclear buttons, aiming to make America first. We can stop this if we fight hard, creatively, and with unity. And the future of humanity may depend upon our success.
According to Dix, we must keep imagining a day when people can transform the political landscape to the points that the political establishment must respond to the demands of the electorate and of the greater citizenry. He believes that no matter how far off that might be, those dreams must be held on to, as they are the seeds of action that guard against fascism. Speakers at Cooper Union's Great Hall agreed that relying on the Democratic Party to win elections and enact progressive policies wasn't sufficient 8 years ago and is not a realistic way to expect change today. They say that what's needed is to grow a collective force that can build nationwide efforts that combat threats to civil liberties, the environment, civil rights, and corporate takeovers of native lands and resources. Journalist and author Jeremy Scahill is critical of liberals who criticized the Bush administration's extraordinary rendition program and war on terror, but were quiet during the Obama administration's continuation of some of those policies, along with their newer, more aggressive policies such as drone warfare.
Where are these people when Obama rebranded the extraordinary rendition program as something else? By the way, it was started by President Bill Clinton, the last Democrat before the 4 years of Cheney and Bush. Obama is the deporter in chief, has gone after immigrants in this country in an unprecedented manner, even making George Bush look a little bit more humane at times because Obama wrapped it in the language of love and concern for immigrants in this country. The upholding of the USA Patriot Act and then its ultimate expansion. The spying that was conducted by the NSA, you don't think Obama knew that they were collecting data on millions of unsuspecting Americans? Of course he did. And his director of national intelligence, James Clapper, went in front of the US Senate and committed perjury when Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon asked him directly, you know, are you collecting any form of data on American citizens? And he lied, and nothing has happened to him. In fact, he's celebrating that he's going to be retiring right now. Let's remember that, look, if you want to speak, my friend, you can speak, but let's let people get their thoughts out. The thing is, if you look at Bill Clinton's administration, and you go back that far, which for some people in this room may be very far, or even before you were born, but let's talk about what happened under Bill Clinton. Under Bill Clinton, the U.S. initiated the longest sustained bombing campaign since Vietnam in Iraq under the guise of the so-called no-fly zones. Clinton presided over the most ruthless regime of economic sanctions in history that disproportionately targeted civilians, particularly young babies, pregnant women, and elderly people in Iraq. And they called those humanitarian sanctions that were aimed at toppling Saddam Hussein's regime. Now, I was in Iraq a lot during that period, and I can tell you that the hospitals of Iraq under Bill Clinton's administration looked like death rows for infants, filled with doctors who were educated in American and British universities, knew how to treat patients of their ailments, but were not allowed to import basic analgesics. They were reusing needles over and over. They didn't have bleach or anything to clean or sanitize, so they were using a resource Iraq had a lot of, which was oil. And so all of the hospitals in Iraq were a mixture of the stench of death, blood, and gasoline. And if you think of the symbolism of that stench in the hospitals of Iraq during this period, it tells you a lot about what Bill Clinton and his administration were doing in Iraq at the time. In 1998, regime change in Iraq became the official law of the United States of America. And you know who voted for that? Well, first of all, let me tell you who wrote it. Who wrote it were the neocons. William Kristol, Donald Rumsfeld, all of the people you would imagine when Clinton was president, wrote a letter under the banner of the Project for a New American Century. And they said to Bill Clinton, we need to make regime change the law of the land in Iraq. And Bill Clinton endorsed that. It then went to the House and the Senate, and Bernie Sanders voted for it.
For Scahill, Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton represented the liberal elite in the U.S., which was an easy target for those on the left to bash, while Bernie Sanders' foreign policy record was ignored.
Bernie Sanders supported regime change in Iraq going as far back as 1998 and never once had to answer a question about that because we were too busy focusing on the kind of cult of personality around this and not the actual issues. I would have loved to have seen Bernie have an actual progressive who knew what they were talking about interrogate him on his own very troubled foreign policy record. You know, we can blast Hillary Clinton like a piñata because it's so convenient, because she's the very representation of everything wrong with the elite in this country, of the thieving, of the cronyism, of the whitewashing of what are called war crimes by liberals under Republicans and then humanitarian interventions under Democrats. Hillary Clinton's the low-hanging fruit to hit at right now. You want to go after someone? Go after someone that, like Bernie Sanders, who's saying, hey, I'm the change that's going to really shake up the two-party system here. But he never had to answer any actual tough questions about his horrible policy positions. Was he better on many issues than Hillary Clinton? Of course he was. Was he saying something that is news to many people in this room? No. What made the difference in all of this was that the media had to pay attention to Bernie Sanders because he started polling high. And Hillary Clinton, she was afraid to say his name for 3 months.
But Scahill points out that areas Sanders spoke passionately about did represent fundamental truths about our financial system and social system.
In Trump's America, the terrain for women is becoming very rough and very physically dangerous. And the misogyny is, of course, intersectional, with women wearing hijabs or perceived as immigrants or women of color being doubly, triply in danger.
Fran Luck, executive director of Joy of Resistance Multicultural Feminist Radio on WBAI, foresees the work of generations on behalf of women's rights being set back unless activists across the country take a stand, regardless of their gender.
The second horseman of the Trumpocalypse is Mike Pence and the Christian evangelists that he represents. They want a woman to lose all autonomy in one of the most important decisions of her life, the right to decide when and if she bears children. Thousands of laws limiting this so far constitutional right to abortion have been passed in state after state, so that abortion is now not obtainable in 90% of U.S. counties, although it is still on the books. There are all kinds of limitations, from forced vaginal ultrasounds to parental notifications to having to travel to other states to get abortions and spend money that you may not have on hotel rooms and all of the costs associated with that kind of travel. That will, of course, increase under a Trump administration. Trump has, of course, said that he will appoint Supreme Court justices overturning Roe versus Wade, that women should be punished for having abortions, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Under Mike Pence in Indiana, we've had recently a law that, we had the attempt, I should say, at a law that would force women to have funerals for fetuses, which is now just passed in Texas. Under Pence, Purvi Patel and other women have been jailed for essentially miscarriages. Okay. So we have that second horseman of the Trumpocalypse, that is Mike Pence. And we also have the right of conscience of the Christian right to deny women birth control in pharmacies and in insurance plans. So the U.S. is in danger of becoming, like many countries in the world, one where abortion is not obtainable, and this results in 60 to 70,000 women a year dying of illegal botched abortions. We are about to join those countries if we do not stop it. Lastly, we have the third horseman of the Trumpocalypse. That's Paul Ryan and his henchman Tom Price, who is the new HHS, Health and Human Services, chief. And that third face is austerity. As a result of male supremacist societies, women make less money than men and are more impoverished and more dependent on public entitlements such as Social Security, food stamps, welfare, Medicare, and Medicaid. These are all programs that Paul Ryan's Congress and Tom Price's HHS want to shrink, want to privatize, want to abolish. So the overall vision for what is to happen for women if this unbelievably anti-woman misogynist administration takes shape and goes forward is a great leap backward into subservience, aka barefoot pregnant in the kitchen. And the modus operandi is if you can't frighten them by threats of physical violence, you can force them to divert their energies into raising unwanted children, like Pence, or you can starve them into submission, like Ryan and Price want to do.
Fran Luck, Joy of Resistant Feminist Radio on WBAI. What the first 100 days in office in the next 4 years will bring is still unknown, but many believe that President-elect Trump won't veer off too much from campaign rhetoric. Whether Trump's campaign promises were born of conviction or salesmanship, the people that he has appointed to his cabinet to preside over the top federal government agencies has caused alarm that a 21st century version of fascism can take form here in the United States. For more information, go to refusefascism.org. Zach Murphy, WBAI News, New York.
Michel Peña Herrera, Nalvia Rosa Menia Alvarado, Cecilia Castro Salvadores, Ida Amelia Armada. Hay una mujer desaparecida.
The call is getting louder for U.S. intelligence agencies to come clean, show proof that Russia interfered in the U.S. presidential election. Meanwhile, activists are pointing to the CIA's role in destabilizing and disrupting elections in foreign countries. This week, Chilean author and educator Ariel Dorfman penned an op-ed for the New York Times, saying, "The U.S. cannot in good faith decry what has been done to its decent citizens until it is ready to face what it did so often to the equally decent citizens of other nations. If ever there was a time for America to look at itself in the mirror," Dorfman writes, "if ever there was a time of reckoning and accountability, it is now."
Clara Elena Cantero, Elisa del Carmen Escobar, Eliana Maria Espinosa, Rosa Elena Morales.
Ronnie Gilbert and Holly Neer with Una Mujer. In the 1970s, with Operation Condor, military regimes propped up by the CIA in Brazil, Paraguay, Uruguay, Chile, and Argentina rounded up thousands of people who were suspected of having affiliations with radical left movements, and they put them into concentration camps and secret detention centers. Many disappeared. They were tortured, interrogated, executed, and secretly buried. Now there's the question of whether a new Condor plan is underway in Latin America. WBAI's Sally O'Brien has more.
Operation Condor has been described as a campaign of political repression and state terror involving intelligence operations and assassinations of opponents by the right-wing dictatorships of the Southern Cone of South America during the late 60s and 1970s. An article by the Washington-based National Security Archives reports that human rights groups, including Amnesty International, were targeted for repression. Quote, "Operation Condor, the trans-border multinational effort by Southern Cone secret police services to track down and liquidate opponents of their regimes in the 1970s, targeted officials of Amnesty International, as well as other human rights groups, and planned overseas missions in Paris and London." The archives cited a comprehensive CIA report on Condor operations, just declassified by the Obama administration, as part of 500 pages of documents on the military dictatorship in Argentina, a commitment the president made during his March trip to Buenos Aires on the 40th anniversary of the military coup. As reported in the Caracas-based Pan-Latin American television network Telesur, among the plethora of formerly top-secret documents is a report presented to the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which outlines that while the main focus of Operation Condor was the domestic elimination of all leftist opposition to, quote, U.S.-sponsored Latin American dictatorships, the network soon turned its attention to left-wing militants in Europe. Quote, the committee report describes that after the assassinations of the Bolivian ambassador in Paris, a Chilean official in the Middle East, and an Uruguayan attaché in Paris, Operation Condor began to target well-known European leftists, among them Carlos the Jackal. Quote, the basic mission of Condor teams to be sent overseas, the CIA reported in 1977, was to, quote, liquidate top-level terrorist leaders. Non-terrorists were also reportedly candidates for assassination. According to a 2001 article in Global Policy Forum, Long Island University political science professor J. Patrice McSherry, author of Incomplete Transition, Military Power and Democracy in Argentina, Operation Condor, quote, allowed the Latin American militaries to put into practice a key strategic concept of national security doctrine, hemispheric defense defined by ideological frontiers. Victims of Condor's Phase 3, writes McSherry, conducted during the mid-1970s, included Chilean Orlando Letelier, foreign minister under President Salvador Allende, and a fierce foe of the Pinochet regime, and his American colleague, Ronnie Moffitt, in military source, told a U.S. embassy contact in 1976 that the CIA had played a key role in setting up the computerized links among the intelligence and operations units of six Condor states. Quote, the intelligence services and armies of the South American right-wing dictatorships, writes Telesur, killed more than 60,000 dissidents in the 1970s and 1980s with the support of the CIA, which was concerned about the rise of the revolutionary left in the region. And in an ominous look towards the future, a December 10th Telesur video, circulated on YouTube, reports that, quote, Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa has denounced a new Plan Condor in Latin America. Today, tactics have changed, the video asserts, but the goal is the same. Destroy resistance to the U.S.-based right-wing agenda. Sally O'Brien, WBAI News, New York.
And that's the WBAI Evening News for Thursday, December 22nd, 2016. The news was produced with Daniel Johnson, Zach Murphy, Sally O'Brien, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.